Take your Bibles and turn to 1 Peter chapter 3. 1 Peter chapter 3. Emerson always wants to take care of me. She made sure I got my piece of candy. And then she whispers in my ear, because she knows me, I guess, already so well, "Don't put it back in there." So I have my Emerson candy right here. I won't put it back in there. 1 Peter chapter 3. And if you found that in the Bible there, you have, or on the screen, or maybe your phone or iPad or whatever means you have to have that in front of you, I'm going to begin reading in verse number 13. And I want you to kind of know that this is this long flowing logic or argument. But argument sounds like someone's kind of picking a fight, but that's not what's going on. There's this kind of long flow of what's really being described here. It starts earlier than this, but we're going to break in verse number 13. "And who will harm you if you are passionate for what is good? But even if you should suffer for righteousness, you are blessed. Do not fear what they fear or be disturbed, but set apart the Christ as Lord in your hearts, and always be ready to give a defense to anyone who asks you for a reason for the hope that is in you. However, do this with gentleness and respect, keeping your conscience clear, so that when you are accused, those who denounce your Christian life will be put to shame. For it is better to suffer for doing good, if that should be God's will, than for doing evil. For Christ also suffered for sins once for all, the righteous for the unrighteous, that he might bring you to God, after being put to death in the fleshly realm, but made alive in the spiritual realm. In that state, he also went and made a proclamation to the spirits in prison, who in the past were disobedient when God patiently waited in the days of Noah while an ark was being prepared. In it, a few, that is eight people, were saved through water. Baptism, which corresponds to this, now saves you. Not the removal of the filth of the flesh, but the pledge of a good conscience toward God through the resurrection of Jesus Christ. Now that he has gone into heaven, he is at God's right hand with angels, authorities, and powers subjected to him." The early bird got the worm this morning. Did you see it? I didn't see it. It was too early. But the English proverb tells us that the bird, had the bird not gotten to it early, he would have missed the worm. And after a heavy dew on the ground this morning, if you happened to be out this morning, you would have seen it. You might have felt it under your feet or on your shoes. Why would a bird not look for a worm in wet ground? Why wait till drought? The early bird has got to get the worm. Proverbs, we learn them early. Maybe you learned a good name is rather to be chosen than great riches. Character is more important than wealth. Now, this is a Hebrew proverb. English people often live as though wealth is more important. Okay, well, I'm going to start over. And there are two times that should have been fairly humorous. And this is going to fall way apart here in about 2 seconds. It could be you learned that a friend loves at all times, and there is a friend that sticks closer than a brother. Recently, I heard a pastor describe the depth of relationship that comes with a church family. He remarked, "It washes out the blood." The mutual commitment to Christ often brings us friends that do more than our own family. And for those who wrestle with the question, "What am I supposed to do with my life?" maybe you learned this proverb: "Trust in the Lord with all your heart. Do not lean on your own understanding. In all your ways acknowledge him, and he will make your paths straight." The Hebrew proverb suggests the clarity of your way is related to the recognition of your limitations. There's one English proverb that needs some adjustment, if not outright elimination, from our use. No good deed goes. See, you know it all too well. The problem with the proverb, as it has developed, lays in the emphasis.
The good is diminished by the punishment. One could easily invoke this parable once or twice and become personally convinced that pursuing the good is nothing short of masochism. If I keep doing this, then I'm just going to keep being punished. And who wants to just continue being punished? So immediately the proverb leads us to thinking that maybe we would fare better, we would face less punishment, less difficulty, if we just not worry about the good. But doing the good is always the right pursuit. Now, when we talk about the good, the one thing that's problematic for us is we've spent most of our lives trying to assure people that are good people that being good is not enough. So we have to define, what is Peter describing when he's describing the good? And what do we mean when we tell someone that being good is not enough? Well, what we have historically done is we need people to understand their need of Jesus. And so no matter how good of a person they are, we work really hard to help them make sure they're not as good as they think they are. Some are really successful at helping people feel this way. Not as good as they think they are. But what happens is when we do that in our conversations, in our vocabulary, and the logic that follows, is that we actually don't talk about the good much. Because we're afraid that if we talk about doing good, then what we're really saying is someone's life might be put in relationship with God a little bit better if they just do the good thing. But Peter's logic is a little bit different. Peter's language, his vocabulary, is emphasizing this fact, this reality, that doing the good is equal to holiness, or doing good, doing the good thing, is what leads us to godliness. So pursuing what is good, pursuing the good, that good action, that good decision, actually for Peter is a means whereby those who are faithful to Jesus can recognize, oh, that's how I know I'm making progress. I mean, after all, if we shun all of our talk about the good, then how are we going to personally know, have any kind of successful idea that we ourselves are actually being faithful if we mark out everything good as off limits? Or if we just prefer to talk about something other than the good? I want to say that there are a series of Christian thinkers in the last, say, 50 to 100 years who've tried to push us to return to a notion, understanding of virtue, such that the understanding of the good is an expression of the reality and presence of God. That seems to be what Peter says. So if you are facing trouble for doing good, that really is his premise. Look back there, if you will, in verse number 13. And what harm, and who will harm you if you're passionate for what is good? Or who will harm you for doing what is good? Now, when we start there, we probably need to kind of get a little bit of the setting. And because Peter invokes the term suffering, and maybe some translations persecution, immediately our minds have raced to what we've witnessed on television, maybe in YouTube videos, where we understand that what's taking place is someone is suffering physically for their faith. And we believe it's one of the highest expressions of faithfulness for someone to declare Jesus is Lord under the threat of death, and then even to suffer that. And so there's a long history in the church of martyrdom, people dying for their faith. And with the current climate in our world and the oppositions that Christians have faced at the hands of ruthless people, religious and non-religious, we take any kind of reference to suffering and persecution to be weighted if you've lost your life. So what happens when that becomes the dominant mode of thinking, that persecution is related to losing your life, if that's what really dominates our understanding of suffering and persecution, then we're going to miss Peter. Because right now in Peter's time, when he's writing, we've not yet got to the places in Rome where they were suffering death. Peter's time, the period he was writing prior to his death, the kind of persecution or suffering he was facing was social, and it was infrequent. In other words, it wasn't something that was systematic. That's what we think happened later under Domitian and Trajan, some years after Peter would have written this first letter. What he's talking about, or what he's writing to, are people who have come to follow Jesus in a culture and in a climate that is either entirely pagan, that is where there is an understanding there are many gods, and now you've opted to say and declare that there's only one. That can bring problems. Or you can be someone who believes that there is a God and others who have said there is none, and that can cause you some problems. And so for Peter, persecution in this particular context, in the era where he is writing it, is really akin to being socially shunned, socially exiled. Now, that may kind of unsettle us a hair, but remember, we're trying to be faithful to the period when Peter wrote, what was going on, and what we know about the history of the church, and when this widespread, systematic persecution began to take place where people were losing their lives. So now we have a vocabulary in the Scriptures where we understand that our faithfulness to Jesus has direct consequences to our social experience. You ever have one of those? Yeah, see, I'm not sure we would recognize what that looks like. And I'm not saying that because we've not done anything that results in that. I think we've become so accustomed to the idea that if in our faithfulness to Jesus, some people are going to be resistant, some people are going to kind of reject us. But few of us have faced the sort of social exile that was going on in Peter's day. When we talk about social exile, I'm not talking about simply, you know, nobody waving at you passing down the street. You know, we're talking about your being not included in the goings-on in your particular community, where you are kind of the pariah, or you've been bracketed out. So here you are in your neighborhood. Maybe you live in Springwood, and maybe your name is Otalara. And people have found out your faithfulness to Jesus, and there's some resistance in your neighborhood, and so they've gone in and they've bracketed out your house. So whenever there is a community event, whenever there is some community information, whenever there is a community need, you aren't solicited for participation. Instead, you are excluded from that. That's what we mean by social exile. It means that in every arena that you and I would normally be included in what a community looks like or the shape community would take, where we would be called on to maybe help cook a meal for someone who lost a loved one, where we might be called on if there were a fire down the street and all the community were getting together to help put out the fire, we'd be excluded. Social exile is the experience where someone recognizes you're faithful to Jesus and decides to bracket you out of any sort of participation in that community experience. In other words, it's like saying, you don't exist in our neighborhood. You ever have that experience? Not really. But that's really what's going on here. That's really kind of the thing that kind of pops up every now and intermittently. It's an informal sort of denial of personhood and denial of participation. The question really comes to us is have we practiced that sort of thing? In other words, are there groups of people, are there individuals in our own communities where we practice the reverse? Where because of the things that we know that they're about and the things that they do, we actually bracket out them as participants in our community, in our neighborhood. Oh, you know who lives over there? Well, they just won't ever help with anything. We're just not going to ask them anymore. Well, if my house were burning down, I wouldn't go solicit them. You never have any feelings like that toward anybody? Don't raise your hand. I don't want to create any kind of embarrassment. But you know that that is precisely kind of the practice sometimes that we do. Or we might find it that they're not Christian. And immediately judgmental thoughts begin to kind of permeate our minds. And we begin to kind of exclude them from any, you know, really deep friendships or relationships. Because after all, you know, we can't be unequally yoked, even though we probably don't really get the context of that particular passage in this setting. You see, so how to mine what's going on here for us is a little bit different. Because if we're not facing social exile because of our faithfulness to God and Jesus Christ, then trying to fathom how it is we could ever come up with an English proverb, you ready, that would say, no good deed goes unpunished, is to really decide that it's too hard work to do what's good. And I just am looking for an excuse not to do it. Does that make any sense to you? That really, if we're not facing any kind of sort of social, by the way, I'm not encouraging it. I'm not hoping that happens to anybody. I'm not hoping that we do that to anybody. But I'm simply saying that if the language that we use to describe our experience is going to include an English proverb that is now, I bet I hear it once a week. No good deed goes unpunished. That it has a debilitating sort of, experience where we just decide, wow, I'd rather not face the social scrutiny. I don't like the punishment and I don't like the suffering. And I just want to say, boy, that's a really wrong-headed way to go. And I think Peter actually is trying to encourage those who would be experiencing this social exile to say, hey, listen, you got to keep doing the good. Because if you don't keep doing what's good, and this fly's kind of got me here, and he's not doing very good, really. But what really he's encouraging is, listen, you be faithful. Because what happens when we say no good deed goes unpunished, our focus is on the punishment, not the consequence of the good. You see, so that then becomes the frame of reference is internal to, I don't like that experience, so I'm just not going to participate in the experience that will result in my sort of suffering. Not going to do it. We prefer a therapeutic model in our faith most of the time. I want to do what's going to make me feel good. Peter comes along and says, no, there's another frame of reference for your doing good. It's the resurrection. In the resurrection, if we're going to take a model for someone who suffered for doing good, don't you think Jesus would be it? And we don't ever view Jesus. None of us ever look at Jesus and go, well, he's just a do-gooder. Never do we say that. We never say things like, well, you know, Jesus, you know, his goodness isn't really going to get him anywhere. We never say that. In fact, what we say is if there's an illustration of someone who, what does the text say, went about doing good? What better illustration of someone who went about doing good? And so what was the end game for Jesus? What was the goal? What was the telos? What was the thing that, well, eventually we know that his good deeds were punished. And I tried my best to come up with a new English proverb. I just couldn't figure it. So maybe we should work on it together because I don't really like, it's not over till the, I just don't like that. You know, I don't really like that. But we need some sort of English proverb that draws attention to the fact that that moment where we face some difficulty for being faithful isn't the final word. Because what happens to us is we internalize those moments of suffering and persecution where we then take in turn, we develop some sort of Messiah complex that, oh, I can't. Oh, look, I suffer every time I do something good. Man, listen, can I tell you, nobody really wants to listen to anybody do that. I mean, if you've got a Messiah complex, let's just get rid of it. There's only one. And Jesus doesn't need you to be one in his place. Right? So what happens here is if Peter's setting up the logic to say, if you experience suffering for doing the good, you have a long look and see what happened in the resurrection. That God has the final say in the resurrection. So whatever we encounter, whatever we face in faithfulness to Jesus, we could call it ridicule or social exile or persecution or suffering, whatever it is, if we seize on that existential moment where it pains us emotionally and mentally, we have forgotten that that's not the final word. And instead, we've actually taken that in ourselves and we've said, oh no, that's defeated me. I'm so defeated by that moment. I cannot believe that person treated me that way. I can't believe I was excluded from that group. I can't believe no one would talk to me simply because I happen to want to pursue some good for somebody else. When we internalize that, it's so easy to fall into the trap of no good deed goes unpunished. And when we do that, again, we're taking our eyes off who has the final word. And we're deciding that someone else has the final word over us and who we are. And in the risen Christ, God has the final word over us. In the risen Christ, God has the final say what happens to us. And in the final say, it's the resurrection of Jesus that shapes a fresh new awareness of who we are and who we are in Christ. So that when we face those moments where it appears difficult to us, where we might use the word suffering, where we might claim some sort of persecution, we're not seizing on that. We're not making that our deal. We're not making our ordeal our ideal. Instead, we're saying, no, God gave the final word in the risen Christ. And that's what I need to hold to. And he introduces this thing that is, I have to tell you, because of the way we use the language, is sometimes irritating. Is it okay for a pastor to be irritated? Just checking real quick. But it's sometimes irritating because I want so bad to use the word blessed and blessed. Don't you? But sometimes the way that language gets invoked is to actually draw out that somehow I'm more privileged than somebody else. That's really not what we're saying. Blessed really is the awareness that God has the final word. So that in the face of suffering and difficulty, I can say with confidence, I'm blessed. Because blessed doesn't mean that I've received something good. That is, I'm going to get something personally gained out of this. No, blessed means that I have a longer look at this, and resurrection is the final word. And we celebrate Eastertide, Easter for 8 weeks. Because we believe that one thing that is missing is we hit Easter, we celebrate the resurrection, we gather on that Sunday morning and we say, He is risen, and the congregation says, He's risen indeed. And we go, man, this is fantastic, we're celebrating Easter. But then we move on to the next thing. And quickly, the risen Christ fades into the background. I know He's not supposed to. But when we move so quickly from Easter, we don't have much time to abide with the risen Christ. And Peter says the solution for us is to set Christ in your heart as, read it, Lord. Ah. So he's not just giving us the long look to say resurrection has the final word, but he's telling us that if we set Christ as Lord in our hearts, then that provides a particular perspective that, well, I'm not, nobody else is either. So nobody has control over my response in difficulty. They're not Lord of my life, and they're not Lord of my responses. And sometimes when as the writer John in 1 John says, when my own energy fails, I tell myself the truth. Set Christ as Lord in your hearts. I know it was a weird way to start with the parables, and that's probably what took you off guard, because there wasn't a parable really in this, except I mind the parable a different way in Peter. Because there's this one last thing that I think is worth paying attention to. In fact, there's a lot there. There's a lot in this passage that opens up to us. But there's this one line in verse 17 that I think that I want to kind of focus with as we end, because we often don't know what to do with our suffering, because most of the time we want to find out who caused it. Whose fault is it? So this is this sentence, "For it is better to suffer for doing good." I wish the period was right there. Because then it says, if that should be God's will, then for doing evil. Now, what that sounds like at first glance, at first read, especially in English, is that it's quite possible that there could be an occasion where it's God's will that you suffer. I bristle a bit at that because, well, I tell you what, I'm heartened when I go open up the original language. And this isn't a time to show off education, but it is a time to say that sometimes when we go from one to another, we miss. And in Greek, there are conditional clauses. There are two that deal with reality. That is, there are two conditions that are just almost always possible possible realities. So those are called first class and second class. Okay. So basically, you could translate those instead of if, sometimes first class, you could translate since. The actuality of what's described is so likely, you might as well consider it a true thing. It's happening. It's just, the probability is nearly 100%. When you get to the third and fourth, it's not in the realm of possibility. In fact, when you get to the fourth class, it's like, it would be, let's call it a miracle for it to occur. And the sentence contains a fourth class conditional clause. It's almost as if Peter says, and if you could ever imagine the likelihood that it could possibly be that God would be the one causing you to suffer, it's still you ought to be doing good. So we shouldn't read it like, well, your suffering is the consequence of God's will. We should be reading that if ever there were a possibility, and it's not really likely that it will ever be possible, but we'll leave it out there that one in a million, you still ought to do good. You still ought to do good. No matter if it were even possible that God were the one. Because it's far better to suffer for doing good than doing evil. Wow. Don't you think? Yeah. Yeah. So I struggle with titles all the time because sometimes I don't think they really get all the way. But I thought maybe we should, no good deed goes without reference to the risen Christ. That could be our new parable. That's not real catchy. I mean, no good deed goes unpunished is more catchy, but I really think that no good deed goes without reference to the risen Christ. That whatever we're doing, the final word is in the resurrected Christ. The experience or the reality in the present is Christ set as Lord in our hearts. And we ought to always, always, no matter what the conditions or the possibility of conditions, we ought to pursue what's good. Because there, I think, we go back to John 14. The passage that we used in our repentance time. And Judas the Less's question about how is it you're going to reveal yourself to us but not to the world? And Jesus' response is a clear indication that God will reveal himself in Jesus through those who follow him. Now, if we really want to have a good participation in the revelation of God in Jesus Christ, then it shows up in the good that we do. If you love me, keep my commandments. By this will the world know that you're my disciples, by your love for one another. We want to be always declaring the risen Christ. Yes? Then no good deed goes without reference to the risen Christ.